You're listening to On Human Rights, where we bring you interviews from experts around the world. We highlight the latest and most interesting trends and bring you information on human rights and international humanitarian law. My name is Nikita Lorenzo Calling, and we are broadcasting from the Raoul Wallenberg Institute in Lund, Sweden. David Zingranelli is a professor of political science at Binghamton University of the State University of New York. He also is the co-director of the Binghamton University Human Rights Institute and has written widely on human rights, democracy, governance, and labor rights. Welcome. Tell us a little bit more about yourself, please.
Yes. What I'd like everybody to know is that I've been studying human rights, global human rights patterns, for over 40 years. I started in the 1980s. And the way our project works is that we develop numerical scores for the extent to which countries respect various human rights. And we look at all countries of the world. So I've been doing this a long time. And I became interested in what we're talking about today, labor rights, after reading many reports about what was going on in countries of the world. And I realized that at the forefront of many democracy movements and many other progressive movements around the world, especially in developing countries, labor leaders were often there. They were sometimes religious leaders, sometimes student organizations, but labor was usually present, and government often violently repressed their attempts to make their governments more democratic, to advance other progressive policies. So I realized that this was important, that I should pay more attention to what's going on with labor around the world, since labor leaders were being targeted so much. It was especially true in Latin America, but it was true in many other countries as well, especially weaker governments. So, and the other thing that you should know is that I'm part of a collaborative effort that involves faculty at other universities, where each year we and our students attach those numerical scores to a wide variety of human rights. And I want to just let you know that the University of Rhode Island is involved as a key player in this process. So is the University of Connecticut and a colleague here at Binghamton University. So it's not a one-man show. It's a big job. And we each teach a seminar every year with students to score the countries. And then we oversee that process. The other thing I would say to people who are listening today is that there is a 2023 global rights report, which will be available as part of the link to this podcast, where you can see the actual findings regarding which countries in the world respect 25 internationally recognized human rights the most. You'll see that Sweden is near the top of the list in terms of that respect, and which rights are most and least respected. And this, our discovery, which is shown in that report, is that worker rights are among the least respected of all human rights. And that surprised us, quite frankly. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today.
Thank you so much. So your work has delved into the intersection of human rights and governance. Can you shed some light on any common trends or patterns in countries where labor rights are inadequately protected, and what implications these trends have for the labor unions and the affected workers?
Yes, I'll try. When I think about what's going on with labor rights around the world, first, I want to talk to you about what previous research informs my thinking. Previous research shows that it's unlikely that governments protect the right to things like an adequate minimum wage, occupational health and safety, reasonable limitations on work hours, including making sure that overtime work is only voluntary. They don't respect those things unless workers are able to organize and collectively bargain. So I believe that the research is pretty clear that only when those empowerment rights for workers, their ability to form unions and then collectively bargain with employers, and unless those are protected, none of the other things that workers care about are likely to be well protected. So I think that's important to keep in mind. I think of the right to organize and collectively bargain as gateway rights to the things that workers care about. And what we also know is that government respect for these gateway rights is in decline and has been in decline for some time. And I'm trying to figure out why. So are my colleagues. We know that democratic and rich countries protect all labor rights more than authoritarian and poor countries do. And we also know that the quality of democracy is declining, right? Not everywhere, but in many places, scholars talk about democratic backsliding. Remember that the world changed a lot in the early 1990s with the breakup of the former Soviet Union. Many countries that were previously dictatorships became more democratic. And at that time, around 1990, we were very optimistic. In fact, a book was written called The End of History that lots of people, by Francis Fukuyama, lots of people paid attention to, and Francis Fukuyama felt that future was going to be rosy. I think looking back on it, it's quaint, and even he admits that he probably overstated what was going on there. But we know that democracy is in decline in many parts of the world, and even in Western Europe, which is a leader in democracy, we have threats to democracy in places like Hungary that are disturbing, that are concerning. And I think that that is leading to a decline in labor protections in many parts of the world. As democracy declines, labor rights are likely to decline. We see what is happening in Argentina is in the news as I speak today. Labor unions are protesting the new president's policies of neoliberalism. So I think we have to talk about neoliberalism, which is austerity, economic austerity, which is being pushed by the International Monetary Fund and is being accepted reluctantly, I think, by many governments as what they need to do in order to get IMF loans. And that too is undermining the strength of unions around the world. Economic globalization. We all know that that is increasing. By economic globalization, I mean the amount of economic transactions that take place between any given country and other countries of the world through imports and exports, and other kinds of interactions among companies. That is increasing. It has been increasing for some time, and I think it's probably geometric. Well, with that increased interaction comes more competition. So every government wants to increase its exports, its share of exports. And that means that costs have to be cut. And one way to cut those costs is to reduce the share of profit that's paid to workers. So I think that that's another problem that's leading to the decline in gateway labor rights. And the last thing I would mention to you that I think is important to think about is the rise of nationalist and populist movements around the world. People in Europe, I think, are well aware of what's going on in Hungary and maybe what's going on in the United States. And those movements, I think, have distracted workers from their true economic interests and have prevented them from pushing for labor union formation and stronger laws to protect them when they rebel against corporate policies.
So, considering low government protection for workers, then, Could you elaborate on the relationship between labor unions and corporate policies? How can these two entities interact in contexts where government safeguards are lacking?
Understand that government safeguards are lacking in most countries. I want to step back for a moment and think about how labor rights are protected and how it's different the way in which other human rights are protected. Let's compare your right to free speech or your right to be protected from being tortured or your right to a fair trial. Those are all rights that the government directly affects. The government determines how good the courts are, what the rules are of evidence, and that sort of thing, and ensures that you have a fair trial. And that has a direct effect on your ability to exercise those rights. With labor rights, it's important to remember that the government is not the primary violator of labor rights. Employers, companies are the ones that violate your labor rights. If you are in the private sector, and most people are in the private sector, I think in every country of the world. Well, maybe not every country, but the vast majority of them, certainly in the United States and in Sweden. So that creates a different situation. So while companies and their workers interact in all countries, in the least economically developed countries, large agricultural, mining, and oil extraction companies have their way with workers. And this imbalance, where companies call the shots and workers are at their mercy, that actually was true in the earlier history, modern industrialized countries. Until 1934, workers were repressed and the laws of the land allowed it. So government joined in with employers in repressing worker rights whenever they tried to form a labor union. Companies hired private guards to discipline workers, and government didn't stop it. So for many decades, workers were repressed. And I think if you were to look back at the early history of any country, you will see that at the earliest stages, when workers try to push for some voice over the terms and conditions of their work, that government joins companies at trying to stop it. And why that is, I'm not entirely sure. That would take us off on a tangent, but it took, 50 years for that to change in the United States. And I think most developing countries are going through that right now. The second phase, historically, and this is a historical argument that I don't make, but others have, is that eventually industrialized countries get to the point where they, instead of suppression, they move to a phase of toleration, where they try to be more or less even-handed in their, whether they're favoring workers versus companies in conflicts that are inevitable between the two, those two groups. And then a few countries move from toleration to actual support for workers by government. I think Sweden is at that stage where they're among a handful of countries where the government is clearly trying to support workers in their attempt to get good protections of things like their wages and protections from hazards in the workplace. Because governments, I think, eventually come to realize that most people are workers. They're not employers. There's way more people who are receive paychecks than write them, right? And government shouldn't be concerned so much about the total size of the pie that their nation is producing, but it should be equitably distributed so that most members of society can benefit from economic gains. We're not there yet in the United States. You may be there in Sweden, and I think eventually most countries will reach that stage where they'll see that. But right now, we're all fixed on growth in GDP and GDP per capita, and not looking at so much at the distribution of the benefits of economic enterprises among the members of societies. So, as I look at other countries that don't respect these rights as much, they're still in that early stage where they're convinced that the way to compete globally is to compete by driving the cost of labor as low as possible, by reducing the social safety net. And I think that that's causing a great deal of problems around the world.
Thank you. So if we take the Tesla case in Sweden that's currently ongoing as an example, how do you evaluate the role of national regulatory frameworks versus corporate policies in addressing the labor rights issues encountered? And what lessons can be drawn from this case for other multinational corporations operating in similar contexts?
That's an interesting question. I'd like to answer that by taking a step back. It's really important to remember that companies and workers typically take adversarial positions about how much attention corporate leaders should pay to what workers want concerning the terms and conditions of their work. So that's absolutely predictable. It exists everywhere. And I think corporate leaders everywhere typically prefer to distribute most of the profit from their activities to shareholders, not to their workers. So that's an assumption that I make when I look at this conflict. So the relationship between workers and companies are predictably adversarial, and it's unbalanced, right? That companies almost always have more power than workers. That's certainly true in the United States and most other countries of the world. I can't speak to Sweden. And the role of government is to make sure that workers have a fair chance to have their concerns heard. And without government policies protecting workers, companies like Tesla and Amazon can do whatever they want to keep unions out. And if they can keep unions out, they can prevent collective bargaining. And if there's no collective bargaining, there won't be respect for things like health and safety and the other things that workers really need. What I find going on with Tesla is what I would expect Tesla to do everywhere in the world. What I think is different in Sweden is that your government has put strong laws in place to make it easier for workers to hold their ground, to resist what are very predictable policies from companies. And other national governments haven't put those same kinds of policies in place that regulate what kind of abuses employers can put in place against their workers.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So, incorporated into this, then, there's a long-standing battle on accountability. And through your work, you've highlighted the importance of measuring and assessing human rights conditions. So, what do you think are the shortcomings or successes of international frameworks in addressing labor rights violations in a multinational context?
Another really interesting question. So, when we talk about democracy and democratic countries providing more protection for human rights in their laws and in their actual efforts to protect worker rights, the assumption here is that most people want protection of labor rights and that politicians wanting to be elected know that. And if they protect labor rights, they will earn re-election. And other politicians who promise to protect it will get elected. So that's accountable. If you enact policies that hurt workers who represent most of the people in your society, you should be punished if the democracy is working properly. The problem is, in terms of the larger international framework, is that particular nations can do a good job with this. And I think Sweden is doing a good job with it. But capital is mobile. So the problem is that if you want to build a large, I believe that a healthy union movement is one of the things that builds a bigger, stronger middle class, which I think is healthy for all societies and is under threat with increasing economic inequality. That labor rights are one of the few levers that a government can pull, protecting those to keep that middle class strong. The other things that countries can do is they can have a progressive tax system, taking more from the rich and helping the poor, and a progressive expenditure system, having more policies helping the poorest, most vulnerable populations. So that would be great if places that make those efforts didn't face flight from the companies they are trying to regulate for the sake of the larger society. And I don't know how we solve this. I think there was a proposal a few years ago that the OECD countries, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the basically rich countries of the world and mostly democratic countries of the world, that they develop a common corporate tax rate, a minimum corporate tax rate. And they couldn't do that. For example, that Ireland has a much lower corporate tax rate than the rest of Europe. And so many multinational corporations have headquartered themselves in Ireland. Well, if that anarchy continues, where there's a race to the bottom for taxing companies and regulating their labor practices, I don't see much hope. So there needs to be more cooperation among the members of the international community in their corporate policies, in their labor protection policies, or expect companies to play this game of exploiting workers until they're kicked out, going someplace else, and exploiting them there. So if you think about the United States, the auto companies left the city of Detroit, went to other countries where labor costs were lower and regulations were weaker. Now they might come back to Detroit because Detroit is desperate. It's an unfair game, and it's because we have a system of global governance that is so weak. There's no international governmental organization. Even the European Union can't get its act together to get its members to do things like have a minimum corporate tax rate. So that's how I see the international framework and its effect on labor rights and other things that could build a bigger middle class.
Thank you so much for that insight and for being part of this podcast and sharing your experiences and knowledge and your expertise. It's been very interesting to hear what you've had to say. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.